This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Tom Cruise puts his life on the line for his audience once again in Mission Impossible Fallout. We also share our thoughts on the Academy's recent changes to the Oscars, in addition to some of my thoughts on some independent features, Blindspotting, and don't worry, he won't get far on foot. But we're going to get things started with, of course, Mission Impossible Fallout. Definitely pretty much the lone blockbuster we've been looking forward to for the second half of the summer, because there's very little outside of more interesting independent features to really discover, but it's safe to say that in the land of superhero blockbusters, Tom Cruise is still the king. He returns to his role of Ethan Hunt for the sixth time in Christopher McQuarrie's Mission Impossible Fallout. McQuarrie also directed the previous entry, Rogue Nation, and the film does serve as a bit of a sort of follow-up to the previous entry, which essentially, you know, I wrote here, essentially it's another entry in the spy franchise that makes every other blockbuster this year look tame by comparison. But essentially, you know, just to set up sort of the overall story of the film, essentially we're 2 years on from the previous entry, Rogue Nation, and the remnants of the villain of that film, Solomon Lane's syndicate, have formed a new group headed by this mysterious figure known as John Lark. They couldn't, I mean, what a name. Of course, they pick a name that is just like, of course, John Lark. That makes perfect sense. Intent on essentially acquiring three plutonium cases, and essentially the rest of the film is made up of Tom Cruise doing his usual thing, putting, as I alluded to in the intro, putting his life on the line for the audience, quite literally in some instances, which we're going to talk about some of these stunts he did, which is pretty insane, but that's nothing new for anyone who's followed anything about this franchise. And obviously, we've alluded to in the past that, you know, I'm a huge Tom Cruise fan in particular. Obviously, you know, I love him in drama, particularly Magnolia, which is one of my favorite acting performances ever. But the thing about Tom Cruise, he's just so engaging on the big screen, and that's something, you know, people always say, oh, he is that throwback to the movie star, because there are stars nowadays, but no one has that, I don't know, like, there are better actors than Tom Cruise, but no one has that inherent, just, I don't know, connective tissue to the audience. I feel like, as I said, you know, he puts his life on the line for the audience, and he's just willing, there's no actor more willing to, I think, to entertain their audience on a grander scale, and it's safe to say this film sort of makes that abundantly clear. And obviously, a lot of the joy from most of these Mission Impossible films is just watching Tom Cruise doing these exceedingly insane things on screen. And, you know, say what you want about Tom Cruise, but obviously, that's the undeniable thing about him, is that he's just willing to go to lengths that no other actor in the industry is at this point. And that's something that I just find sort of so enjoyable. But obviously, one of the big backstories to this film is that Cruise infamously broke his foot on one of the stunts that is in the movie, which is, you know, just important. But they've made a lot of, they've shown the clip over and over again how he, like, broke his foot, and then he just, like, goes through with the scene and continues running on and on, which is just classic Tom Cruise. But safe to say, there's a crazy amount of stunts in this film that he performs that are insane. There's literally a scene where Tom Cruise, I don't believe Henry Cavill did it, but Tom Cruise jumps out of an airplane at 25,000 feet, and he, like, that's literally him. That is not CGI. That is him. And there's shots where he literally had to, like, contortion his body and get in the right area so the camera could get the right shot. It's insane. Tom Cruise is acting at 25,000 feet in the air, and he's, like, pulling it off seamlessly and getting in the right position for the camera. It is insane, and this is just why I love him, you know, so much as an actor. And it's just crazy the amount of things he does. I mean, and that's only sort of scratching the surface, but that's the one they've been talking up recently in terms of what he did. But I'll turn it over to you, because obviously I focus so much on these stunts, we're not even really talking about the movie, just Tom Cruise's insanity, which is obviously one of, you know, the big benefits of this franchise.
Oh yeah, this man will die on a Mission Impossible set someday. It's ultimately, the film lives and breathes through Tom Cruise, and I feel that if you had another actor in there, the franchise would not be what it is today, because I don't think too many actors are willing to put themselves on the line. And even just, like, there's a scene where he's riding his motorcycle against traffic, and, you know, there's a scene in the trailer where it's not a spoiler, where he tumbles over on the motorcycle. Like, that scene, even just him driving against traffic, is fucking terrifying to watch. This man is, I don't know where he gets this kind of courage to pull this stuff off, but man, I am very glad that he does. This movie is a blast, just and you know, even kind of taking in the evolution of this franchise, where even the worst one is actually a pretty fun John Woo movie. This is a really reliable franchise, and I think taken for granted just because they haven't reached those dizzying heights in terms of the choreography of the stunts and the choreography of the action scenes, which has just gotten better and better. You know, bringing in Brad Bird for the fourth one, Ghost Protocol, was a huge step forward, even after the J.J. Abrams one, which was a lot of fun. But I actually would advocate, and I know I've been very sour on the IMAX experience in the past, but on a whim, I just happened to go see this one at the IMAX. I sat back far enough, but not too far back, where the sound was actually pretty good instead of that usual boomy, muddy, muffled stuff that you get. And obviously, the last 25 minutes is just something to behold, where it takes up the entire screen. Most of it is kind of cropped in that, you know, pseudo widescreen ratio, but then when the whole thing gets going and that last little helicopter chase, which is just pure insanity, which I think was actually a real helicopter chase too. It's hard. The best success that I think this film pulls off is that your jaw is frequently on the floor by what you're watching. It is just like, it is auteurism through action performance, and I don't think anyone else aside from Tom Cruise can pull that off. And you're right, he is the for my money the best action star that ever lived, and he's just proven that again and again. And even in movies like Doug Liman's Edge of Tomorrow, he has this charisma regardless of the role he's playing. It's just like, it could be the smarmiest person, or it could be, you know, more more even-tempered Ethan Hunt, and it's just incredible what this guy can pull off, and the fact that he draws you in, and he just has this great chemistry with McQuarrie, and they both have this intuition, and I think they both know what benefits the film best, and it's just really uncanny to watch. And I know there have been comparisons to Mad Max Fury Road in terms of action films of the decade that are kind of pushing those limits. I think that's apt. I think this is an incredible film to watch. It might not be as completely insane as Mad Max Fury Road, but that's, you know, a completely different setting. So for what is being presented on screen, I feel that it is the appropriate amount of insanity, even if it is dialed up more than it has been in the franchise prior to this point.
And you mentioned Christopher McQuarrie, the director who also, as I alluded to, directed the previous entry, Rogue Nation. But I think what stands out about this film in particular is that not only, obviously, the insane stunts, but each action sequence sort of is different. They vary it up. Like, you have that, there's some before this, but there's that bathroom brawl where there's no score to it. Like, it's just, and it's been in the trailer, so you probably know what we're alluding to. But it's just this bathroom brawl, and they just choose, oh, you know what, we're not going to have a musical score. We're just going to let the impact and the punches hit, and it really works because of it. And then you alluded to, you know, motorcycle car chases, the insane helicopter mountaintop battle sort of at the end over plutonium. That just says it all right there. But I think one of the success of the film, obviously, it's obviously really dependent on Tom Cruise and also Christopher McQuarrie, but what I thought that was interesting about this entry is there's interesting elements that they sort of include in the film. Like, there's a couple of dream sequences where we sort of start with one, but there's one in particular that I thought was really great, where it's the sequence where essentially Tom Cruise is, you know, thinking or imagining himself as like sort of John Lark, you know, this head of this syndicate, and he's going around, you know, in order. There's this sequence, essentially there's this set piece that they're going to build up to, and they start off, before we even see the set piece, they do an entire dream sequence of it, you know, to make it seem like, oh, Tom Cruise is going to always killing cops, he's letting this get to him. I thought that was a really interesting choice, because we get to see, you know, how Ethan Hunt at least, you know, imagines himself going down a dark path or something like that, and just the cinematography of that sequence in particular, I thought was really, really effectively done. And that was something that just stood out as something different for this franchise. And you allude to the fact, I mean, this franchise is really so consistently entertaining. Like, this is one of those blockbuster franchises where you're like, oh, you know, it's going to deliver now at this point, just based on the array of entries, essentially from 3 on. I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't seen Mission Impossible 2. I always hear people really hate it, really dislike it. I know some people find it passable, but I don't know. It seems like since 3 on, not to discount anything in terms of Brian De Palma's first film or anything, but starting from 3 on, they've just sort of been very crowd-pleasing, and Tom Cruise just sort of upping the ante constantly, and it just really works because of it. There's some other things I've noticed about this franchise that really intrigue me, and there's one element that, like, that I've thought about from the last entry forward, and how, like, it seems like Ethan Hunt has a very specific type of woman, because this is something that I feel like not enough people are talking about, how Rebecca Ferguson and Michelle Monaghan are almost, like, essentially they're the British and American version, but they look very similar in a very similar bone structure that it almost blows my mind. And I'm just baffled that people don't even like make this connection. Obviously, Rebecca Ferguson, her character isn't a love interest per se or anything, but it seemed like there was allusions to it in this film or some tease of it. And I just thought that was really intriguing. You get these two female actresses who almost look so similar, but serve and their characters are completely different and function differently. I don't know. It's just something that's really, it's just something that jumped out to me as something that I noticed. But, you know, essentially this is a blockbuster that has everything. You know, we talked about Tom Cruise's, you know, star power, Christopher McQuarrie's incredible directing of the action sequences. But as I allude to, that, you know, obviously there's engaging performances outside of Tom Cruise. And there's even some moments of comedic relief that I thought were really effective. In particular, this isn't necessarily complete comedic relief, but it's a moment that I thought was really just fascinating where Tom Cruise, you know, we're in this sort of climax of the film and he happens upon his ex-wife in this place with her current new husband, played by Wes Bentley, who just couldn't have his head more in the clouds and is just happy. And all I could think about was, I guess it's just because there's so much beauty in the world, he just can't take it. And I had to squeeze it in there. It's a reference. Those of you who get it will get it. But I don't know. That's immediately what came to mind when I saw this scene and how he's just like has his head in the clouds acting happy. He obviously doesn't know that literally the world is at stake and his wife does. I don't know. I just thought it was such a weird thing to be in this movie, but I thought it totally worked. It's just Tom Cruise happening upon this, then adding another sort of emotional element to it, but adding just a weird dynamic. I don't know. I just thought it was really fun just to see Tom Cruise, you know, is being paired off with his ex and her new husband. I don't know. It was just something. It was just a fun moment with obviously weight to it, considering what Ethan Hunt is trying to accomplish at the time in the movie.
I think that scene is actually reflects what the movie. All right, so it's hard to say a movie does, you know, that this movie does one thing particularly well over another, because I think it is a complete package. So I wanted to touch upon how Christopher McQuarrie, out of his action direction, kind of threads the plot lines together and gives every character a little bit more nuance and weight and motivation that they didn't have in previous movies. That kind of elevates it a little bit more in my mind. I still think it's a little bit short of Ghost Protocol, but I digress. It's incredible that for ultimately what's, you know, basically a ticking bomb device that's used at the end actually has palpable suspense just because of that tightness in the direction and because of the dramatic heft that they give the characters. And that's something that's really all I want in a summer blockbuster. I want to care about it a little. Sure, I'm totally okay with, you know, having no emotional attachment and just watching complete carnage as long as it's fun carnage. But every once in a while, I do appreciate a little bit more thoughtfulness in this. And I don't think this is going to be a game changer in the way that Mad Max or even The Dark Knight were, but I do think it is a prime example of the changing landscape of blockbusters. And for my money, it's the best blockbuster of the summer. I don't think that's even a contest. It just has you know, say what you want about the Avengers having emotional weight. In here, it felt more natural and not necessarily like just like a plot device. I think everything just kind of coalesced together at the end perfectly, and it gave what should have had absolutely no suspense a lot of suspense and quite a bit of fun. And honestly, I know it's going to be another 3 years before we get another one. Tom Cruise, please don't die.
Well, yeah, I think it's safe to say, obviously, we're making a lot of the fact that Tom Cruise is putting his life on line. Obviously, they go through all these safety procedures, but there is still inherent risk in all of these things that he does. So it's important to keep in mind. But as you mentioned, this is sort of, you know, definitely one of the best Mission Impossible films. I'm probably with you where I still probably prefer Ghost Protocol slightly, but definitely I'm definitely with you. This is, you know, a great blockbuster achievement, easily the blockbuster of the summer. I did just want to mention, I feel like one criticism of the film, if I have one, I thought the use of Henry Cavill's character, essentially he's this CIA agent, August Walker, who essentially is working under Angela Bassett, and he's, you know, entering, and he's essentially, you know, sort of has to watch over Ethan and make sure he doesn't do anything crazy, let the plutonium, whatever. But essentially, I thought the use of the character, the way they did it, I thought it could have been more effective. Like, it feels like in this franchise, and like, I mean, I'm going to say slight spoiler alert, because, or maybe I'll just say spoiler alert, just so if you don't want anything spoiled for you, because I have to talk talk about this, and I have to talk about the trajectory of the film, but essentially Henry Cavill's character and the way this franchise works, you know, when there's a new actor entering into the series like this, you could probably assume that he's going to be villainous of some nature. And, you know, I'll be honest, when the film started, I didn't necessarily have that, but I felt the way they handled his character and the way that it's revealed that he is, you know, this villainous figure, you know, I thought it could have been much more effectively done, because there's like this scene where Henry Cavill is talking to Angela Bassett, and he essentially gives away the fact that he is the villain. He doesn't, like, oh, say, but he's, like, setting up Ethan Hunt to, like, take the fall. I just felt like, wouldn't it be more effective if they took this scene out and then had it revealed after? And that was just something that jumped out to me. I also felt like some of Henry Cavill's line delivery, it felt a bit stilted at times, but it wasn't that noticeable. Admittedly, it may just be overanalyzing him, because I thought his performances in both Batman, Superman, and Justice League were god-awful. I just don't think he's good for that role, in that role or actor. But it's interesting, because I expected more from him in this role, because I previously saw him in another spy film, very underseen, but I actually recommend it, Guy Ritchie's The Man from U.N.C.L.E., where Henry Cavill is a very smooth, charming spy. And if you want to see him, see what he's capable of as an actor, I definitely recommend checking that out. But I think he works in this role. I just felt at times the use of the character, it wasn't as effective as it could be, but obviously this film gets the highest recommendation from both of us.
But now we need to talk about what I feel that maybe we're overreacting to. Maybe I'm just an overly emotional person who's afraid of change, because so much has changed in my life over the past couple of years. But the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences yesterday announced a couple new things. First and foremost, the thing, and all right, so they announced the new category. Let's get out of the way, because that's the thing that's pissing me off a little bit less than the other thing. It is called Best Achievement in or Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film, which, who the hell, I don't even know what the hell that means. And, you know, everyone was saying that, you know, that using the classic Don Draper line, that's what the money's for. Like, you know, I don't, it's just bullshit to me that, and it obviously they've done reactionary stuff for, you know, like The Dark Knight not getting nominated 10 years ago, expanding the Best Picture category to 10, which was a little cheesy, but at least that wasn't like really, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for is here. I just think it's unfortunate in a year when you have a movie like Black Panther that, for all intents and purposes, probably would have gotten nominated for Best Picture anyway, even without this new category. It just it's almost like a sidelining category, like Best Animated Feature, when there are animated features that are very clearly good enough to stand on their own against the best of the and deserve to be in the Best Picture competition. So it just seems like they're kind of keeping them at arm's length. And I don't think any documentary has ever been nominated for Best Picture, now that I'm thinking about it. Foreign films are few and far between. I think The Artist is technically the only foreign film that's ever won Best Picture, so that should tell you everything you need to know. But it's really, I don't know, it's just crap. They're keeping these filmmakers who really do a lot of great stuff, and obviously Mission Impossible Fallout might even deserve to be in that conversation. Christopher McQuarrie pulled off a fucking miracle with what he did on the film, and they deserve to be in the in contention. And they're just going to fall by the wayside. I know it's all a ratings game at the end of the day, but 24 million people watched the show last year. That's not exactly small numbers. But that is also the less significant thing that's bothering me. They're also cutting the show down to 3 hours, which is the length of the Tonys, if I'm not mistaken. And they're going to be giving out some awards during the commercial break, which I have very, very strong feelings about. I can't imagine that if they moved, let's say, oh, I don't know, Roger Deakins to a commercial break last year, I think you would have had a lot of people calling for the head of the Academy on a platter. I just think this is something that's once a year, you know, we're in a world where WrestleMania is like 7.5 hours long now, but the Oscars are shrinking. I never thought I'd see that as a child, that growing up, the thing that I have grown farther from has become longer, and the thing that I still love kinda is shorter. I don't know. It just hits me in a couple different emotional ways. And I'm trying to keep it into perspective and knowing that this is not going to affect my life. It's not going to affect the world at large. This is just someone fucking with my hobby. And in a world where you have very few pure joys left, that's really shitty.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, like, when I initially heard, oh, the Academy makes changes, I sort of like shrugged. I was like, because I don't really know what to expect, but based on the sheer amount of backlash, I felt like I had to think about it more and wanted to obviously talk about it here. And as far as, you know, obviously a lot of this stems from apparently pressure from the network ABC to sort of, obviously the ratings is one of the big things, and as you mentioned, you know, still 20 some odd million viewers, but it was the lowest rating, you know, so of course they want to, you know, try and make some changes. But when you're letting a network affect how you run sort of supposedly the most
prestigious film awards, although, you know, admittedly, I enjoy the Oscars. Don't get me wrong. I look forward to it. But rarely does it award the films that I wanted to, or performances. And I'm happy when people I appreciate like it. But I guess I'm a bit like, I like the Oscars and I love enjoying them. But I'm a bit like, I don't think it's ruining the sanctity of the Academy Awards or anything like that. I think that's a bit misplaced. But I do think that, you know, by bringing it down to 3-hour broadcasts, obviously they're going to take out some of our favorite categories and sort of not shine a light on things that are important parts of filmmaking. I think that's the thing that's unfortunate. And obviously, they've alluded to the fact that these people may win their awards in commercial break, but they're going to show it on the actual broadcast. I mean, now hopefully that will, you know, and I can see how that would at least still give them a forum to give their speech and stuff like that. But I feel like this is going to lead to some issues, you know, whether it's, you know, cutting or editing speeches. You know, this is just going to make their jobs a bit more crazy, and they're going to be doing this during the broadcast. I don't know. It just seems a bit tricky for them. And obviously, I want people like the cinematographers, editors, sound designers to be able to get their moment in the sun as well, because they rarely, if ever, do outside of that. But obviously, we have the best popular film category. And this is interesting in a sense that, you know, it's sort of like, and I saw some people make comments, which I agree with. It's sort of like, oh, we're going to make a separate but equal in the year of Black Panther. You know, it's sort of like, you know, oh, we have the best film, and then we have the best popular film. In a year where, you know, with the expanding of, you know, how many films can be nominated by Best Picture, this is a year, oh, Black Panther could get in there. It could get in Best Picture. But now with this Best Popular Film, it's like, oh, well, now Black Panther has to be in that, and it can't possibly be in the Best Film category. And I think you guys can sort of inherently see the flaws in that approach. So it's sort of like, you know, I understand why, we want to bring up ratings, and it would be great for different films of different genres to be able to get recognition, but it seems like in recent years they have been already. Like, there is progress with things like Get Out, a genre sort of horror film that would never be in that position before. Obviously, you know, the Mad Max, you know, they expanded the categories from, you know, stemming from, you know, Dark Knight and all that, people talking about that, and it seemed like the right decision, but this seems like almost a step too far. And I will say, I'm very intrigued to see if they stick with this based on the background. I'm very intrigued to see how it plays out, and I'm willing to give it a chance, but it really, it feels like a very slippery slope, especially in this year when, you know, there's more diversity than ever in the blockbuster form, and these people who haven't had the opportunities are getting these opportunities and achieving unparalleled success. And then it's like, oh, you know what, we're going to give you your own category. And then what does that mean? How are people going to view this? It's just a tricky, very slippery slope. And while my initial reaction was a bit of a shrug, I definitely see a lot of the inherent flaws in this. And I do say I am curious to see how this plays out and if they stick with it, but I think it's a slippery slope, and I think it could lead to more than a few disasters, and safe to say, criticisms of their handling of whatever the situations are.
Yeah, I think I'm ready to put this controversy to bed until we get closer to the ceremony, but I am calling it right now. I think the biggest controversy of the award season will be that Black Panther will be nominated at the Golden Globes for Best Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy.
Oh, God, I didn't even think of that, but I can see it now. But, I mean, it's the Golden Globes. They are meaningless. And I just go to the Golden Globes for drunk people being entertaining. So if you really put weight in the Golden Globe winners, you need to, all I'm telling you is you need to rethink your priorities, because the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, they certainly, I would not call them a legitimate organization that's awarding the best in film. They're awarding, you know, what publicists told them to do. That, you know, it's the truth. So I don't care what these people think. That's just the honest truth about the Golden Globes in general. But obviously, I alluded to the fact I did want to share some thoughts on a couple of independent films that I definitely highly recommend, that I definitely recommend people search out and look for. And the first film is a film, Blindspotting, which is definitely a film that needs a bigger forum, because this is a film that, like, it just blew me away. And I have to say, I saw this at the Providence Place Cinema. I was the only person in the theaters, like a Friday and like 12, you know, 12 noon or whatever, something like that. But this film, I mean, it's so unique and so timely, but has so many different elements that made it just an incredibly enjoyable experience. And essentially, it centers on this character of Colin, played by David Diggs of Hamilton fame, who essentially is trying to make it through his last 3 days of probation in Oakland, despite the unhinged nature of his childhood best friend, Maya, played by Rafael Casale. And essentially, David Diggs and Rafael Casale co-wrote co-wrote this film together. And it's really interesting to see their dynamic play out because it's such a unique way to tell this type of story. And, you know, what's really surprising about the film, though, is it's not only incredibly powerful, but it's also incredibly hilarious. There are sequences in this film that I was just laughing hysterically. There's this infamous barbershop scene with female hairstylists and David and Rafa Kazal coming in. And I don't want to say anything about it, but you just need to see this film. You need to see it. There are some lines in there that are like references to film that I wasn't expecting in this film that just really made me lose my shit. So I definitely recommend it on an entertainment level, but it's also an incredibly powerful story, and it obviously, you know, a lot of it centers on, you know, racial relations, obviously in contemporary society in Oakland, and sort of dynamics between those in power and not particularly police officers. Although I was surprised they handle it in a different way than I expected in this film, where it really feels like at times where it's just, you know, Colin and Miles going on the streets of Oakland. They're part of this moving business. They go around and they just interact with different people. And David Diggs is just telling Raphael, oh, put your gun away. I don't want to go back to jail, please God. And they also intertwine, you know, why David Diggs went to jail. It's a really interesting subplot and backstory that adds a lot of the emotional power to the film itself. But, you know, what really struck me about the film, and this obviously stems from some of his work in Hamilton, where there's a number of scenes where David Diggs is just sort of like, he's working through his thoughts through rap, and he's just walking down the street with Miles, and it's a musical number or anything. He's just like saying a couple lines or two where he's working through his thoughts on these things and dynamics. And then at the end, so essentially this is a running thing, and then at the climax of the film, he comes face to face with the police officer played by Ethan Embry, and this scene is just unbelievable, where he just goes, where essentially it's like all those thoughts just come pouring out of him, and he goes into this crazy enraged sort of rap, but it's so powerful and effective. And it's just a scene where it's like, you know, Ethan Embry is a very small part of this film as this police officer who essentially, you see it in the trailer, where he essentially guns down someone in David while he's sort of, there's this really intriguing aspect of it that I won't spoil here, that it sort of adds to David's sort of the dramatic tension of the moment. But, you know, he's essentially set up as, you know, David sees him kill this unarmed black man, and then he's sort of, you know, we don't really see him again until this climax, and it just really builds, and it's really powerful. But I definitely encourage everyone to really seek this film out, as it's really unique, really powerful. And I think even, you know, even if this is something you're like, oh, subject matter, you're like, oh man, like some people, like, they just can't do it. They just don't want to experience it. But honestly, this is a film that you definitely would, because there's lots of entertainment value to it, but it's also powerful and it tells a story in an unexpected and unique way. And this is a film that I feel like definitely needs a wider audience, because man, this is safe to say something else. But I also wanted to share my thoughts on another feature that I ended up seeing, which is the latest film from Gus Van Sant, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. And this stars Joaquin Phoenix, as I talked about in the last episode, my favorite actor, the best actor on the planet, but he stars in another sort of very lived-in performance as John Callahan, who's essentially this alcoholic who, after this life-changing incident, gets put in a wheelchair and sort of has to fight through his emotional battle with, you know, either relapsing or going through the different relationships in his life. And it's really interesting and definitely different than I expected, but essentially he comes to being a cartoonist and uses that as sort of an outlet for it. But there's this really interesting setup in this film where there's a number of sequences where he's sort of part of this AA group headed up by Jonah Hill's character Donnie. And I have to say, I mean, I've never seen Jonah Hill give a performance quite like this, and I feel like you really want to seek this out, because it's really unique and interesting and just a different type of performance for him. We've seen him sort of move into dramatic realms. Obviously Moneyball was one of those big roles. In recent years he's done other stuff as well. There's this upcoming series on Netflix by Cary Fukunaga, Maniac, which I couldn't be more excited for, with him and Emma Stone, which would really be exciting. But I don't know, his performance in this is definitely worth seeing, because it's just a different, I always am encouraged when I see actors sort of really stretching their limit and pushing themselves to different places they haven't been before. And safe to say, this feels like Jonah Hill doing that here as well. But it's really a film that just feels intimate and real throughout different sequences. Jack Black is also great in another small role. He essentially has two scenes, which couldn't be more different in tone. But you'll understand when you see the film what I'm talking about. But man, the second scene is just an emotional powerhouse and a great moment between he and Joaquin Phoenix. But it's another film that's, you know, really emotional at times and then really funny at times, much like Blindspotting, but it really leaves a mark on you. And it's definitely the best I've seen from filmmaker Gus Van Sant since his Harvey Milk film, Milk. But these are both two independent features that I definitely highly recommend seeking out, as they're definitely, I definitely really appreciate them. And especially in a summer where there isn't a lot to cling to in terms of blockbusters outside of Mission Impossible, I definitely recommend seeking a lot of these different types of films out, as because they've been really rewarding for me in particular.
Yeah, I won't belabor the circumstances that led to me not seeing these films, but it was mostly the fault of the theaters for not showing these movies at more times throughout the course of the week, which is just a kind of a pain in the ass. And the fact that there was only, I think each of them was only playing at one theater, that's neither here nor there. I think instead of, you know, obviously, and we just talked about Mission Impossible, I don't think Mission Impossible needs to be playing on five screens in one theater, though. So I think that they really, being a little bit more judicious about how they divvy that kind of thing up would be a little bit more advantageous for me as a film goer. But I do want to open that up a little bit now that I'm on that point about how, you know, there's this idea, obviously MoviePass is going under very hard, and that's probably going to be out of business by the end of the year if I had to put money on it. But what would it take to get, you know, audiences like us back to the theater? Is it just the fact that, you know, it's Phantom Menace syndrome where everything is a franchise and people are too lazy to seek out these films? Or is it just that TV has gotten so good that people don't feel that they have to leave these homes? Because I think most people probably won't care about Dolby Atmos and high dynamic range and all that. You know, they're not a nerd like me, but I just, you know, it's disappointing. And I know that these types of movies are not going away. There will always be people like us that will continue to seek these films out. So I don't think we're in danger of losing this joy, but I just wonder what it would take for the general public at large to get back to these types of films.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you there. It's always depressing, like I said, seeing Blindspotting in a theater where I'm by myself, and it was only playing at Providence Place in our state, the only theater where it's really playing, and it has very limited screen times as well. It's just unfortunate, because these are films that are, as I talked about, very unique, very powerful films and unique experiences, and that's the thing why, you know, I've mentioned this previously on previous episodes, I'm sure, but when people say, you know, they don't make films like they used to, I feel like people are looking at sort of the mainstream and the blockbuster, and they're looking at only those films and not looking at all these other really inventive and interesting independent films because they're not being shown on enough screen. So it's just unfortunate that these films didn't get sort of wider release, at least in our area. But if they are released in your area, I definitely recommend checking them out. And even if they're not, definitely check them out when they come to on demand and online. But with that in mind, I guess we can turn our attention to next week, where we'll be checking out Spike Lee's latest Black Klansman, along with Bo Burnham's directorial debut, Eighth Grade.
To prepare, I'm going to go through Bo Burnham's stand-up again, because the guy is just genius. But as always, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.